Matthew chapter 5 and verse 21 as we consider another in our series of making application from the Sermon on the Mount, in particular to our family relationships. Jesus says, "You've heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother hath aught against you, leave there your gift before the altar, and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly while you are in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver you to the judge, and the judge deliver you to the officer, and you be cast into prison. Verily I say unto you, you shall by no means come out thence until you have paid the last farthing." We've looked at the Sermon on the Mount pretty much as a whole thus far. We began with an overview of the Beatitudes and the fact that they describe the character of those who will be kingdom citizens. And so it is the Christian, the disciple, the child of God, who is described in Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 through 12. It is the Christian who is poor in spirit, who mourns, who is meek, who hungers and thirsts after righteousness, who is merciful, pure in heart, a peacemaker, who endures persecution for righteousness' sake. And that individual is a mother or a father, a brother, sister, a child, or parent, a husband or wife. So these are the relationships we sustain in life, and the point we've been making based upon 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 4 is that we have a responsibility to learn to show piety at home first. And the principle that we extract from that is, in 1 Timothy 5, 4, is that this Christian character of which Jesus speaks here in the Sermon on the Mount ought to be reflected within the confines of the home. This is how we are to interact with our spouse and with our children and with our parents and with our other family members. And we need to give emphasis to that relationship first, because those are the people we have, over whom we have the most influence, and those are the folks with whom we interact the most that are Christians. We need to learn to live the life of Christ at home. And then Jesus goes on to say there in that fifth chapter that those who possess these attributes, this kingdom citizen, that he is both salt and light. And thus he's talking about our influence. We are salt, we have a preserving influence. So just as we take salt and add it to meat, or perhaps add it to canned vegetables or whatever it is that we have a desire to preserve, to perpetuate, to stop the putrefaction thereof, so we, as disciples, when we are introduced into the world, we are to be salt. We are the preserving influence. But we are the preserving influence in our family. That is our chief responsibility as fathers, gentlemen, is that we are to lead our family to Christ. I have made this point before, and I make it again, this idea of diminishing the importance of the home as a field of evangelism is narrow-minded and short-sighted. Noah saved the world because Noah saved his family. Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and out of Shem came the Christ. So Noah, the great man of faith, saved the world by saving his family. So we are to be busy about rearing our children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. And too many preachers have lost sight of that, and they've lost their children while they're busy trying to do evangelistic work or church work or whatever they want to call. what they're doing when they ought to have been trying to live the Christian life at home and preserving their children. And we are light. We are the light of the world. We are that city that is set upon a hill that cannot be hid. We are that light that's not to be put under a bushel. And I believe in the context of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is primarily concerned about that concept of hypocrisy. If the salt loses its savor, or if we take the light and we put it under the bed, or we hide it under the bushel, what are we? We're hypocrites. Do we appear to be something to others that we are not at home? And are we trying to shine a light which is really not a true light, because it doesn't really reflect our true character? You know, one of the things I have come to realize in trying to serve the Lord is you can't fake it for very long. You've got to be sincere and earnest about serving the Lord. And you've got to get up every day with that determination that you're going to be faithful to God, and that you're going to give Him His due, and that you are going to make the very best effort you can to be a genuine disciple of Christ. And in those moments and hours and days when we are discouraged, or we really haven't had the commitment that we ought to have, something's going to come along, and we're going to jump the tracks. I've seen too many people do it, whether it's because of a job reversal, or because of a tragedy of health, or financial problems, or a failure to set proper boundaries with regard to their relationship with spouse, and they become entangled in sin, and they're gone. And the wake of destruction that is in their path is horrible. So Jesus picks up at verse 17 there in chapter 5, and He begins to talk about, we did this at length last time in our study from these chapters, that there is a real threat presented by hypocrisy. The hypocrite, the word hypocrite means to put on a mask. And so we appear to be something that we are not behind the mask. And so the hypocrite appears to be righteous. He stands on the street corner, we read there in chapter 6, and he sounds the trumpet, and he does his alms to be seen of men, and he makes long prayers on the corner for a pretense. And he disfigures his face and throws dust in the air when he fasts, all of which is done in order to be seen of men. And Jesus says in those contexts there, particularly in Matthew 23, as well as here in Matthew 6, they have their reward. They were seen. They got what they were looking for. They were seen of God as well. And He will render His judgment accordingly. He wants us to not let the left hand know what the right hand is doing. He wants us to go into our closet and pray. It's not that we have to be in a literal closet, but our prayers do not have to be public. Our prayers do not have to be seen and heard in order to be seen and heard by the God of heaven. And we need to clean ourselves up and anoint our faces and our hair with oil and go about our business, not to be seen by others, to be fasting. God, who sees in secret, He knows what troubles my heart. He knows my desires. He knows my intents. And so Jesus is talking about those who say and do not, and those who violate the law and will of God by tradition. And He urges us to be neither a lawmaker nor a lawbreaker. We are to be lawkeepers, according to Jesus. Whosoever shall break the least one of these commandments, verse 19. Now that's what the Jew did in his hypocrisy. He sought about ways to break the commandment. He'd count those seeds, but he wouldn't lift a finger to help a brother overcome the burdens of their traditions, or raise a finger to take care of his mother or his father. Well, here in the context, Jesus introduces the formula, "Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time," and He'll use that throughout chapter 5 in several paragraphs. And what he's talking about there is tradition. Since you've heard it said by them of old time, here's what the fathers have said. Here's what the rabbis have said. And verse 21 is a little bit difficult because the law of Moses actually says, thou shalt not kill. Is Jesus taking issue with that commandment? Certainly not. And one must consider the context of the Sermon on the Mount and this relationship of this text to the prior context with regard to hypocrisy and the whole exhortation, accept your righteousness, exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. In other words, it's not just to be seen, it's not just to be viewed as technically righteous. The Apostle Paul addresses that concept that I'm talking about over here in Romans chapter 5. When he talks about the justification that's by grace through faith in the death of Jesus Christ. And he says there, speaking of the death of Jesus, he said scarcely, verse 7, for a righteous man will one die, yet peradventure for a good man some would even dare to die. The righteous man is the man who externally conforms to the law. He's not a murderer. He's not a thief. He's not an adulterer. You see? So externally he conforms to the law. He's not a law breaker necessarily. But Paul says, who's going to die for that fellow? Maybe for a good man. And that's someone who goes beyond what the law requires. And there were men like that throughout the Bible, both in the Old and the New Testaments. We see these folks who are giving alms. We see someone like Tabitha who made clothes for the widow women. Here's someone who was given to good works. Barnabas was one who excelled in good works. Cornelius is another who excelled in good works, even though he was a Gentile. So you have these folks who are said to have been full of good works, and Paul says, well, maybe for that one somebody might dare to die. And then the point of his contrast in that context is, but Christ died for us while we were yet sinners. And so my point here, though, is that when Jesus is talking about these Jews, they have these external requirements of righteousness. And when I say external, I mean they conform to the law, but they do not necessarily proceed from the heart. The justification that saves a man is the obedience from the heart. That's Romans chapter 6, verses 16 and 17. Ye have obeyed from the heart that form of teaching. And so it is in Romans 2 that Paul talks about the goodness of God leadeth thee to repentance. And then he chastens them over their hardness of heart. What was the problem with Israel? Their heart was hard. They could not be brought to repentance, you see. And so Jesus, in describing the Christian there in the Beatitudes, that poverty of spirit, that's the fellow who recognizes he has no intrinsic worth before God with respect to his own works. It says not the idea of Titus 3, not by works of righteousness which we have done, you see. And what is described there in Titus chapter 3? Well, the whole host of sins of which we're guilty. That's the man who has poverty of spirit, who realizes he's not able to stand before God and claim acquittal on the basis of his life because he knows he has sin in his life. And so that's where the gospel starts, with the poor of heart who mourns. Mourns over what? Mourns over his sins. Who's meek. He doesn't argue with God about what he requires. That's the classic Pharisee, arguing with God. Why do you think Jesus condemned them as he did there in Matthew 15? That you, by your tradition, set aside the commandment of God. God says, honor your father and mother. I don't want to do that, Lord. Let me figure out a way to get around it. There's nothing meek about that at all. The meek man submits to God. He doesn't look for a way to get around it and then come back and say, aha, God, you have to take me because I figured the loophole. hypocrite? You see? So that's what Jesus is talking about there in verse 21. Someone who says, well, I haven't done any murder. I didn't kill anyone. No, but you hate your neighbor. See, that's the point. You hate your neighbor. You vilify him. And you're angry at him without cause. And it is that anger and contempt and vilification that ultimately leads a man to diminish the worth of another human being, forget that he bears the image of God, and then kill him. See, that's where murder starts. That's what Jesus is talking about there in the 15th chapter. He says, look, it's not what you eat with unwashed hands that defiles you. It's not what you put in your mouth, but what comes out of your mouth, which is a manifestation of what's in your heart. Verse 18, but those things which proceed out of the mouth come forth from the heart, and they defile the man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, blasphemies, false witness, blasphemies. These things are the things which defile a man, but to eat with unwashed hands defiles not a man. So it is what is in your heart. So here in this context, Jesus is talking about a heart problem. Anger is a heart problem. Anger is a problem of heart that is incompatible with the character of the disciple, the child of God, the Christian, the citizen of the kingdom of heaven. Someone says, well, wait a minute, preacher. Ephesians 4 says, be angry and sin not. You know, I used to think like that. Try to figure out how much anger can we get away with? How much anger is all right? See, that's pharisaical if you hadn't picked up on that already. Jesus says, be angry and sin not. And here in this context, he says, anger, or he who is angry with his brother without a cause. And someone says, well, my wife, my husband, my children, my mother-in-law, they all give me good cause to be angry. That's not what Jesus is saying, brother. And if you're thinking like that, I hate to tell you, but you have an anger problem, just like I have had an anger problem and have to learn to deal with it. And the day that I was humiliated over my anger was the day that I finally understood Mark chapter 3 and verse 5. Talking about Jesus. And when he looked about on them with anger. See, Jesus got angry. Now read it. When he looked about them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he said unto the man with the withered arm, stretch forth thy hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored whole, as was the other. What is the correct emotional response to anger? Grief. Grief. What is supposed to generate anger? What is righteous anger? Righteous indignation. It is anger for cause, and the cause, Jesus shows us by example, the cause is sin. And my response to that is not to be rage, it's not to be a tirade, it's not to be a stream of accusations and a withering rebuke. It's supposed to be grief. Grief because those people with whom I have every right to be angry are in sin, and they are lost, and they will be in torment. And if I don't understand that anger has to come from a place of love, I'm never, ever going to get to heaven. That's where anger must come from. Anger does not revile. Anger redeems. Anger reconciles, if it's the right kind of anger. And so, Jesus was angry. And so, it's not how much anger can I get away with. The question is, how does anger affect me? Do I have this grief, or do I explode in rage? Do I have compassion on those with whom I am angry, or do I, like Jesus is describing here in the Sermon on the Mount, do I feel nothing but contempt for those with whom I'm angry? Do I see them as men made in the image of God who are on the road to perdition, or do I see them as someone that I just really don't care about, that I can hate because of whatever they've done or whatever they said or however they behaved, and that affected me adversely? You see, the anger that Jesus says that we can have is the anger that gives life. It is not the anger that produces death. You see, when Cain got angry, he was angry with God, and so there's your misplaced anger right there. He's angry with God, but he took it out on Abel, you see. And what did he do? He spoke to him, and then he rose up and slew him. Now, not all murder involves blood. Read the Psalms sometimes and see how David describes those who murdered him with their tongue. Or in the context of what we're discussing with regard to family, in Ephesians chapter 6, Paul says to fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. You see? Do we, through anger, generate more anger? And I have some more to say about that in just a moment. But how you and I respond to these strong feelings of displeasure, and that's what anger is, a strong feeling of displeasure. I don't like something. How I respond to that, and why those feelings arise, why am I having these feelings of displeasure? Those are the things that are going to determine my eternal destiny. Anger is only a justifiable reaction to sin, provided we respond like Jesus did. You're going to have a hard time convincing me Jesus wasn't angry when they were driving the nails through his hands and feet. But when they did that, what did Jesus say? Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Can I be like that with my wife? Can I be like that with my children? Can I be like that with my in-laws? I'm not saying I always have. I'm just asking, is it the way we're supposed to behave? And yes, that's how we're supposed to behave. And when we don't behave like that, we set up a paradigm within our families that is ultimately destructive. Destructive of ourselves, destructive of our spouse, destructive of our children, and the result of having destroyed our home brings havoc upon the church. And if we're hypocritical about it, it really brings havoc on the church, because you don't put an angry man into the eldership. You see? There's consequences to not having dealt with our anger. Just think there. Jesus suspended between heaven and earth and talking with that thief. And he turns to him and he says, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. And that's from Luke 23. But you go over and read the parallels in Matthew and Mark, and there were two thieves that were crucified with Jesus. And in Matthew's account says they both cast the same accusation into the teeth of Jesus. They, in their anger for being crucified themselves, and that justifiably are hurling epithets and insults at Jesus. Say, if you be the Christ, come down from the cross. And then that one fella has the nerve later in the day to say, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus, turning to him, says, go to hell? No. Jesus turned to him and says, this day you shall be with me in paradise. Was he angry? I believe he was angry. I believe he was grieved at what was happening. Father, forgive them, for they don't know what. There's the response that anger should bring. And what does he do? He says, Father, forgive them. Misplaced anger destroys the home. I like old movies, and one of my favorite old movies, and I've watched it, if I've watched it once, I've watched it a dozen times, is It's a Wonderful Life. I know there's things in it that are not accurate as far as the portrayal of angels and one thing and another, but it is about the best portrayal in drama I have ever seen with regard to an angry man. I thought George Bailey was the hero of that movie. He was, but George Bailey was an angry man. And he'd been angry a very long time. His anger started when he had to pull his brother out of the creek because he fell through the ice and he jumped in and he became deaf in his ear. And then later, you remember Mr. Gower slapped him on that ear and he completely lost the hearing. And because he lost his head, he couldn't go and join the army when the war broke out. And his little brother, whose hide he had saved because of the foolish mistake he had made, he got the Medal of Honor, ate dinner with the president. What's George doing? George is back in Bedford, Ohio, at Bailey Brothers Building and Loan, spending his entire life, this fellow who wanted to be a dreamer, this fellow who wanted to build things, this fellow who wanted to travel and see things, who wanted to build bridges and skyscrapers and do great things, who had all these accomplishments in his mind. You know what he spends his life doing? Figuring out how to save 3 cents on the length of pipe. And Uncle Billy, who he had been carrying along in the business, just as his father before had carried him along, he made a colossal mistake. In his pride over his nephew. And it's interesting to me, he even was proud of George and what he had done because Potter had said to him, you know, says, well, what about that other Bailey? He's not getting a medal. And Billy says, well, somebody had to stay here, Potter, because not all the dictators were in Europe and Japan. You see, Billy understood the good that George had done and the accomplishments that he had, but George was frustrated and he was angry, and Billy lost that $8,000, and then the rest of the movie is about him venting that anger and that frustration and that vilification of people. Remember when he comes into the house and the kids are playing on the piano and they're putting the decorations on the tree and Peter comes up to him and says, Daddy, how do you spell frankincense? And boy, he goes off. Why do we have to have all these kids anyway? Why do we have to live in this old draft house? Why do we have to live in this town? And just on and on. All that anger for all those years starts gushing out. And who does he take it out on? You're with me, aren't you? Who does he take it out? Who's he mad at? He's mad at Potter. He's mad at Chance. He's mad at a lot of different things. But who does he take it out on? He took it out on the kids. He took it out on his wife. Why do we have to have a family over here? You know, all of that. He took it out on his home. And at that moment, that fellow was on the verge of destroying all of the important things in his life because of anger. Now, where does that anger come from? That anger comes from pride. That anger comes from desire. That anger may arise because of criticism. That anger may be because others have made mistakes that adversely affect me. Though they weren't intentional mistakes, they weren't trying to harm me. There's no sin involved here necessarily in some of these things. But I'm angry. And those things set me off. Now, there's two things I want to say to you here. One is, you've got to realize that you're going to have to deal with your anger. You're going to have to find out why you're angry. Why do you pop off like that at your kids? Why do you go off in that way? Why do you mistreat people? And then, if you're a real hypocrite about it, why is it that you're that way at home, but everybody in town thinks you're a great guy, everybody in the church thinks you're a wonderful fellow, but you're keeping it bottled up at home and you're angry at the wrong people? Now, when we are angry like this, and this gets back to the point of dealing with it, when we're angry like this, we need to honestly realize what's happening and what we're doing to people. Proverbs 27 and verse 4. Wrath is cruel, and anger is outrageous. And who is able to stand before envy? See, pride, envy, disappointment, all of that feeds anger. You're going to have to deal with that. You're going to have to put that in perspective. Why? Because anger left unchecked is cruel and it's outrageous. It does mean and terrible things. And the other thing you're going to have to learn, back in chapter 15 of Proverbs, verse 1, the soft answer turns away wrath. But grievous words stir up anger. There's two sides of that. We all need to learn that words matter. And anger doesn't justify that. Jesus didn't spew a string of words at those fellows driving the nails in his hands. Jesus didn't denigrate their humanity. Jesus didn't treat them as if they were nothing. Words matter. And then we need to realize on the other side that we can stir up wrath in people by the choice of words that we use. I'm going to read another passage here in chapter 30 and verse 33 of Proverbs. You know, you ought to read a chapter in Proverbs every day. Surely the churning of milk bringeth forth butter, and the wringing of the nose bringeth forth blood. So the forcing of wrath bringeth forth strife. We have a term for that in America. The person who's like that is a button pusher. You know any button pushers? You know just the words to say, just the things to mention that pushes his or her buttons and sets them off? Because they don't have any self-control over their anger. And so you've got to learn not to let the button pusher push your buttons. And if you're the kind of person who's been pushing buttons and you don't like the fact that you have an angry spouse or angry children, then maybe you need to learn how to use better words. And so chapter 25 and verse 15, Solomon says, by long forbearing is a prince persuaded, and a soft tongue breaketh the bone. We've got to learn how to control what we say and realize that what we want to do is not make people angry. We want to change their hearts. We want our hearts to be right. We want to change their hearts so they can be right. Turn back to that 17th chapter, if you will. And verse 14, the beginning of strife is as with one letting out water. Therefore, leave off contention before it be meddled with. Remember the little boy who stuck his finger in the dike? What happens when you meddle with stuff like that? Either you're stuck or the dam breaks. And there are people that they poke at those holes. They do, leave that alone. Don't do that. Don't aggravate the situation. Then just turn the page there to chapter 19 and verse 11. And the king says, the discretion of a man deferreth his anger, and it's a glory to pass over a transgression. And that's another phrase that we have that everybody understands. Scorekeeping. How many families, how many marriage relationships, husbands and wives, have you ever, don't raise your hand, but have you ever known anybody that they like to quarrel, you know, with someone? Maybe the husband, spouse, or quarrelers. Maybe, you know, I wouldn't think any of y'all are like that. But anyway, they get to quarreling. And what do they end up doing? Whatever it is they're quarreling about right this minute, it's not really what's wrong, is it? They got to go all the way back to when this or that happened. And then we've got to start keeping score and rattling off all the things that you did and all the things that she did. It is to your glory to just forget some stuff. Just forget it. It's in the past. It's not going to change. You can't fix it or undo it or anything. All you can do is help that person not to do it again. Get them to understand that they need to change their life and that you need to change, because bringing it up every 6 months is not going to help the situation. Now, if there's infidelity in a marriage and something like that, there are ways to deal with that so we can get past it. But just to not deal with it and just keep dragging it up time and time again like an old dog with a bone, that's not doing anything that's constructive. Now, when we talk about anger, we need to realize, and this is the effect of anger on the home, we need to realize that we learn what we live, and we live what we learn. I don't think that's original with me, but I don't know where I got it. But we learn what we live, and we live what we learn. Proverbs 22, verses 24 and 25, with respect to anger, makes that point. When Solomon says, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man thou shalt not go, lest thou learn his ways and get a snare to thy soul. Young people are the least prepared to deal with anger. Here's a child coming up in a home, and he has an angry father or an angry mother or whatever in the house. And he has these vilifying words spoken at him all the time. And he sees the irrational behavior that angry people manifest. What is he going to become? What are we making out of him? Jesus talked about the Pharisees making one twofold the child of hell. That's what we're doing. I'm thankful my parents never had any disagreements in my presence or my brother's presence. I think that's a good policy. We never did do that before the children. We've had our disagreements. Cindy and I aren't arguers, though. We don't do that. I have been angry, but didn't have anything to do with anything she did, and she's been the brunt of it. That's a sin. It's like that fellow who came home from work. His boss had chewed him out. And he gets at home, and his wife had told him to pick up a gallon of milk, and he forgot. And he gets there, and he gets out of the car, and he remembers it, and he's still angry about his boss having chewed him out that day. And here comes Spot. And he kicks the dog. What did the dog do? And we come in the house, and we kick the wife, we kick the kids, we kick this and that. It's got nothing to do with the family. We need to realize, and Jesus says this in the context of Matthew 5, that when we are angry and we live angrily, that we make it impossible to worship God, because our anger is without cause. It's against those who are not deserving of it. And so Jesus says, when you learn that you've been angry with your brother without cause, and therefore remember he had aught against thee, leave thy gift to the altar, go your way, and first be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer him his gift. Have you ever ridden in the car on the way to the meeting house on Sunday and had such a row at home before you left that you don't even speak to one another, or that you're just so angry you can't even come in and worship God? I've known people to do that. The word for that is hypocrisy. And I want you to think about this, that when we are angry with our spouse, with our children, with our parents, and that is without cause, and they're disciples, we are persecuting Christ. What did Jesus say in Matthew 25 in that judgment scene? In that you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. And in that you have not done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. We need to take this very seriously. Work on our anger. Thank you, Jimmy.
Good job, good job. Good
luck. Thank you, thank you.
As always.
Oh, let's not get carried away.
We're pretty good. I feel like the real stuff.
No, it's not. And I didn't want to miss my notes. Thank you for coming today, and thank you for bringing Oscar.
Always will. He said he loved them.
Okay, good. Well, tell him I will get him some.
Okay.
What flavor?
Peach.
It's peach. Water.
Oh, it's water.
Mama Jean called it sugar water.
That's what she essential stuff in it.
Yeah, it's got 250 calories in it.
It's cool.
Ooh. That's all right.
What's that? What? I grow on her?
Oh, yeah, that too.
No, we're talking about.
Talking about what?
Eating.
Oh, squash.
Yeah, you want to bring some more?
We got to get her
up. Cindy, you want some more squash?
Sure.
I'll have to share my recipe where I scoop them out and stuff them.
You've told me about that.
Oh, man, that's
what
so
good.
You hamburger. Put that sauce. I usually put I put hamburger in there usually.
And you bake him after you put that in there?
No, you just boil it in the spaghetti sauce.
I cut up my crook ends, and then I get me some peppers and some onions, and then get me a can of Prego spaghetti sauce, you know, pour that in there, and put all that in there together. Plus the stuff I scoop out of the squash, if it's not too seedy. Let that cook and cook and cook. And then I take my squash and I stuff them with, it's just kind of like you fix your meat for a meatloaf, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Season it up a little bit, stuff that in there, and just lay that on top. And then you can cook noodles or you can cook rice. We like it with rice.
You have to write all that stuff, man.
No, I got that from my... There's a name for it, but I got that from my Lebanese cousins.
Yeah, it's a Lebanese
thing. It's good, though, boy.
You get to do that this time.
Oh, okay, yeah. You bring the squash. How you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good, where are the kids?
I'm feeling good. She said she'd be here tonight.
Okay. Oh, I hope she's not got something wrong with her.
Not like sickness. That's an ongoing thing.
What?
You need to ask her about it, because I don't want to tell. But okay. You should ask her. Talk to her about it.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So we're supposed to head over there now?
Yeah, we don't have to hurry because Sonny's going to get the...
Okay, you want to go home first?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Hey. With Pine Hill.
Hey, man. Good to see you.
We're billed like Pine Hill water, but...
Other
company
has
operations.
I
got a speaking
tube.
You can't leave without me
speaking tube. No, I didn't. Were you trying to talk to me and I didn't hear you? I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. No, that's okay.
I'm glad to see you, though.
Yeah, that was a good lesson.
Thank you. You and Miriam are all purple and
bright
today.
Okay. Well, you take care.
Y'all look like a bunch of pansies.
Oh, you know, pansies are pretty.
I know. That's what
they're
I'm talking. I know it. That's what I meant.
Have you ever seen a pansy quilt? Pansy quilt.
They're
beautiful. They're purples and light pinks and light orchids. Oh, it's just so pretty. And greens. How are you, David?
You're going to go home and get one started, aren't you?
Uh-huh. I want to.
You'll talk yourself out of it before you get home.
Oh, I sure will.
Hey, are you feeling better?
I am. Yeah.
Yes, you look good.
Good job. I'm feeling 100% better, really and truly.
Well, that's good. I'm
really
glad.
And truly.
You'd had to die to get much worse, huh?
No, you better believe it.
She's waiting on you.
Yeah, she is.
She must be hungry.
Yeah, probably. See y'all tonight. About done. Yeah. I need one of your phone.